regrette rien.
Hi, this is Robert Scheer with another edition of Scheer Intelligence, where the intelligence comes from my guests, someone I've had before this time, Juan Cole. He's a professor of history at the University of Michigan. He's written a number of very important books. I think maybe the critical one that people should read, I enjoyed it and did a podcast, was Muhammad, Prophet of Peace Amid the Clash of Empires. It's a very different view of Muhammad and his teaching that you will find in the normal atmosphere of using Muslim religion as a scapegoat for all that ails the world. And his most recent work he edited is called Peace Movements in Islam. And the reason I wanted to talk to Juan Cole, we just ran a piece on Scheer Intelligence and from Tom Dispatch. Juan Cole pointed out in this piece that for all of the great fear about the Muslims and the Muslims are going to attack us and the Muslims are an unreliable population and we've harassed Muslims in America terribly and around the world, except when there are allies like in Saudi Arabia or Egypt, or when they're being oppressed by people like China, then we can use the Muslims the other way. But basically the uses of fear of Muslims. He points out with the January 6th attack, probably the most serious attack on functioning of American democracy that we've had. It came really from people who claimed to be Christians, white supremacist Christians, and kind of all kinds, and a number of whom are on trial now. So let's just begin with that, this new book of yours, but also your basic thesis that the Muslims have been a scapegoat for instability in America, and it's come from more familiar quarters.
Absolutely. Well, Muslim Americans are a big group. They're about nearly 4 million of them, according to the Pew polling. And so it's a little over 1% of the population. And they've been model citizens. I mean, many of them are physicians and professionals, and they're pillars of their community. But since 9/11, in particular, the Muslim American community has been intensively surveilled and spied upon, even to the extent of the FBI putting saboteurs into mosques to encourage people to talk about violence in order to entrap them and arrest them. Community centers and others have been spied on by the New York Police Department, spied on 250 mosques and community centers in that area. So, of course, much of this surveillance is unconstitutional, and it's been intense. If you're a Muslim American, even just flying abroad and coming back into the country is a hassle. They pull you aside on the basis of your name or your birthplace, and give you the long interview. You're held up at the airport for an hour or two, asking you what your parents did and all that kind of thing. So they're hassled in all kinds of ways and spied on. And perfectly innocent activities have sometimes been, spoken of darkly by U.S. intelligence agencies. Seminars on marriage and things like that that were held in a mosque. In contrast, the white supremacists, the gun nuts, the white nationalists have been violent and taking on the government and being violent is absolutely central to the identity of a lot of them. And as you say, Bob, it was groups like the Oath Keepers and the Boogaloo Boys that staged the January 6th Capitol insurrection. But this comes in a long line of anti-government violence, including, going back to 1995, the bombing of the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City by Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols. So the FBI and Department of Homeland Security and Department of Justice, however, have treated those people with kid gloves. They're not surveilled or monitored in nearly the way that the Muslim Americans have been, even though they stockpile weapons and they plot terrorist attacks. And one of the reasons for this is that the Republican Party depends on the white supremacist vote to some extent, and they run interference for them. So in Congress, the Republican Party has pressured the Department of Homeland Security and the Department of Justice to leave the white supremacists alone. And offices that were dedicated to keeping an eye on those people have been closed down at the insistence of Congress. So it's a complete injustice, and also very unwise, because letting those people freely organize without any attention from law enforcement is what allowed them to plot to take over the Capitol building. And it appears to be that they intended to kidnap or do violence to high officials of the U.S. government, including the vice president and the Speaker of the House.
Yes. Yeah, so what we have here really is just another example of how we pick and choose our enemies. And traditionally, lots of governments have done that, and they certainly can find quotes or statements to demonize, and that's the basis of anti-Semitism, anti-Christian view, anti-Muslim. Religion becomes a handy foil when you're looking for a scapegoat. We know that historically. Sometimes it's political philosophy or what have you, but generally religion has been one. And for much of American foreign policy in the Cold War period, anti-Muslim baiting has been convenient, except when it's not. And I just take people through some of this history, which I would like to discuss with you. But for instance, the Palestinians, who are not a particularly, or were not at the beginning of the creation of Israel and the conflict with Israel, the most fervent Muslim population, nonetheless, because of that, and Israel's conflict with the Palestinian, we have an idea of the Palestinian terrorists, the Muslim terrorists. And that became awkward because the U.S. also wanted to sell a lot of arms to Muslim Saudi Arabia, which actually had a much more militant and extremist leadership of the Muslim religion. And we saw that, of course, that they sponsored, 15 of the 19 hijackers were from Saudi Arabia, and they sponsored a lot of that activity. And yet somehow they got off the hook. And even Israel now has very good relations with Egypt, with the United Arab Emirates and so forth. And yet the Palestinians are somehow in that camp. And then more recently, we have the situation where the U.S. is, I think, picking a fight with China, but there is a legitimate human rights concern of how the Chinese treat a small part of their population and the Uyghurs, who, are Muslims. And it's convenient now to play the Muslim card the other way. We're the defenders of the Muslims and so forth. This was true when the old Soviet Union had its problem with in Chechnya. So why don't we talk about that, the uses of chauvinism in justifying one's foreign policy, indeed one's imperial ambitions?
Well, it's an excellent set of points, Bob. Basically, Muslims have been put under the sign, as you say, of violence and terrorism, except where they're not, where they're actually seen as allies. Mamdani wrote that book, Bad Muslim and Good Muslim, which is really about this U.S. hypocrisy in its approach to the community. This is one of the reasons that I put together that book on peace movements in Islam, is that it seemed to me that there was an imbalance, not only in journalism, but in scholarship, in how we have written about Muslims in world history. And even during the age of colonialism, in the 18th, 19th, 20th centuries, when European powers, and including the United States and parts of the Philippines, went out and conquered these people and took over their countries and dictated their lives, which, in many instances provoked a violent response on their part, and is one of the origins of the demonization of the Muslims, is that they didn't go quietly with colonialism. But actually, if you look at it dispassionately, there were many Muslim movements in the colonial age that deployed nonviolent ways of resisting the European dominance. There was a big movement of Muslims in India, some of them in the circles of Mahatma Gandhi, who adopted nonviolent philosophies and techniques. The Sufi orders in Senegal weren't happy about having the French up their affairs all the time during French rule, but they had an explicitly pacifist ideology and argued that the Prophet Muhammad made treaties with non-Muslims and there was no intrinsic reason to resort to violence. So there were a lot of movements of Muslims working for peace. And after the Bosnia War, where again, the Bosnian Muslims were targeted by fanatical Serbs and Croats, after the war was over, there were lots of Muslim peace groups which worked for reconciliation. So this Muslim peace work has been a big part of modern history, and yet there has been very, very little writing about it, even though peace history, is a big field now, and it has journals, and there's a lot of writing about, Christian peace movements and about the nonviolence in the civil rights movement led by the, mainly by Southern Black pastors with a Christian tinge to it. But there's been almost no, I can't say no because there is a little bit, but there's been almost no attention to Muslim peace work.
Time for a break, and we'll be back in a few minutes. We're back with Sheer Intelligence and our guest.
It's so insulting that one has to defend this major religion, which certainly every religion has had its failings, has had its evil spawn, has also its virtue. I mean, my God, the church, the Baptist church in the South supported slavery and segregation, the white Baptist church. And as you pointed out, the black Baptist church, both claiming to be Christian, were the people who inspired a lot of the civil rights movement. And then we've had, Ireland, Northern Ireland, where people claiming to be Christian who are Protestant do their best to kill people who claim to be Christian who are Catholic, and vice versa. And of course, the killing of Jews in Nazi Germany were done by most often very good, so-called good Christians. But I want to stick to the main point here, but yet refer to an area of major expertise that you bring. Muhammad himself, the inspiration for this offshoot of Christianity, which, by the way, still accepts the main premises of Christianity. And what was so valuable about your seminal work, and I use that word advisedly, on Muhammad, is that you showed that Muhammad, that as far as we know, the actual living Muhammad, was by virtue of his occupation, his involvement in trade, his education, what the region of that looked like at his time, of all the warring factions that a salesperson whom he was had to negotiate going from one country to another. I thought it was a brilliant examination in your book. Maybe we should say something here about where this religion came from and who the person that it's named after is.
Sure. Well, it ties in actually to the new book of peace movements in Islam, because I have a long chapter on the Quran and ideas of peace in it.
This is a Bloomberg book, right?
Yes, that's right. It's IB Taurus. It's an imprint of Bloomsbury. People don't read the Quran. And if one actually read it, it says things like forgive your enemies and do good to those who do evil to you, win them over, and pray for peace and security and prosperity for your enemies. And these verses are never cited by the Islamophobes, and there's kind of a big industry of demonizing what's in the Quran. It also does have verses where it instructs people to defend themselves when they're attacked. And those are taken out of context, and it's made to look as though the book is urging murder, which, of course, it's not. Murder is forbidden in the Quran. Muhammad, lived about 600 years after Christ, and lived in a world, as you said, that was at war between the great empires of the time, the Roman and the Iranian. As a long distance merchant, as somebody embedded in the social customs of the urban areas of Western Arabia, he preferred a path of peace where at all possible. And he wasn't a complete pacifist. He allowed defensive warfare. But I point out that's the Christian stance. I mean, once you get away from the Gospels themselves, the Church Fathers, St. Augustine and St. Ambrose, they all, not only permit, but actually order that innocence be protected from violence and that there's such a thing as just warfare. So I argue that the ideas of war in the Quran are no different from those of Augustine, in that they're urging just war. But the emphasis in the book is on conciliation, on making your enemies into friends and winning them over.
The book being the Quran.
Yes.
Yeah. So let me say, now, the people who make foreign policy anywhere in the world know this, whether they're the rulers of China, Russia, the United States, what have you. And I want to get back to the original theme, which is what we mean by chauvinism, is what we mean by scapegoating. It doesn't really matter what people believe in their religion or practice. Truth doesn't matter. You want to use these people as a rallying cry, the hatred of them. You want to whip up hatred. You want to scapegoat. And you couldn't have a better example than in American foreign policy, where actually we've been quite cozy with really the extreme center, if you like, of a militant Muslim interpretation, which is Saudi Arabia. Yet somehow the United States has not only coexisted with Saudi Arabia, but has sold Saudi Arabia an enormous amount of weaponry and what have you, continues to this day. And the major so-called act of violence that we're talking about was, in a way coddled, at least, if not paid for and sponsored by Saudi Arabia, which is what the original mission of militant Muslims to Afghanistan from outside of the country, and that's how bin Laden got to be there, and support for in one way or another for that sort of militant interpretation came from Saudi Arabia, and 15 of the 19 hijackers, I can never get that statistic out of my mind. And none of them came from Palestine or the occupied territory. 15 of the 19 were good citizens of Saudi Arabia, never gotten in trouble. And yet, in the case of our demonization, they escape it, And so let's just talk a little bit about that contradiction.
Sure. Well, I mean, one of my favorite anecdotes about this is that Donald Trump went on at length about how Islam hates us and he's afraid of Muslims and so forth. Then he goes off to Saudi Arabia soon after he's elected in spring of 2017. And he's buddy-buddy with all of the Saudi bigwigs. And he actually joins in with the sword dance. You can see it on YouTube as Donald Trump dancing the sword dance with all of these armed Saudis. So he doesn't seem actually to be afraid of them. And of course, he wasn't. It was all rhetoric on his part to play the rubes. I would say, Bob, I don't think the Saudi government had anything to do with 9/11. I think there obviously Osama bin Laden was a Saudi. But those people are the Al-Qaeda types were the equivalent of our white supremacists. And they had gotten in trouble with the Saudi government and had their passports taken away, had to run away to Sudan and Afghanistan. Among the hijackers, there were a lot of Saudis, but Osama bin Laden picked, they were handpicked by him from his group. They were mostly the muscle in the operation. So, you know, the thing I point out to people is that the Saudis are very heavily invested in the U.S. stock market and the Saudi wealthy and the elite. And it's predictable what would happen to the stock market if an operation like 9/11 were pulled off. And it did happen. I remember I lost a lot of money in the stock market. Of course, it was a tragedy in much more serious ways. So many people were killed and so forth. But the point is that nobody who was heavily invested in the U.S. stock market would want to see a 9/11 happen. And the Saudi elite certainly did not. So I think we have to make a distinction between Al-Qaeda and the radicals who, again, are like our own homegrown radicals, willing to use violence, stockpiling weapons, hating the government, and the Saudi elite, which has its faults and their traditionally preferred form of Islam is a xenophobic and hard line, and very different from the Islam of most Muslims in the world. I mean, the Senegalese and the Egyptians and the Indonesians are mostly appalled by the attitudes of the Saudis. The fact that the Saudis had this hardline version of Islam and promoted it around the world, as you said, never interfered with the United States supporting the regime in Riyadh to the hilt. And indeed, it's been useful at every point in modern history because the U.S. tried to deploy the Saudis against the communists. And I don't want to excuse anything on the Saudi part, but I have to point out that the idea of getting the Saudis to give money to jihadis, to people who wanted to fight holy war, was Ronald Reagan's. There's every reason to think that the Reagan administration pressured the relatively, at that time, timid Saudis to support the Mujahideen in Afghanistan and started giving people the idea that it's all right to take on a superpower with these irregular Muslim religious forces. So the U.S. is implicated in a lot of this turn to violence and paramilitary activity and used it against communism. And then they've been interested in using it against Iran and so forth. So sure, the policies are full of contradictions and hypocrisies. And the overall lesson that, you know, of the some 14 major non-NATO allies, the vast majority of them are Muslim states. The United States has designated them as allies.
Including Turkey.
Turkey, Egypt, Bahrain. They just
so visited. Let me just pick up one historical point here. I'm you know, and I hope I didn't misrepresent the Saudi regime, but it seems to me that they have given room I mean, Bin Laden came from a very respected family, and there were flows of cash. But I don't want to go into that. But I'm just talking about the uses of a view of the Muslim religion as inherently violent and primitive in its fundamentalism and so forth. But I just take the example of Israel, for example. I think I certainly know very little about this compared to you. But I was in Israel and Egypt at the time of the Six-Day War, and the Palestinian population was not particularly given to a very fervent fundamentalist view of Islam. And also the Palestinian population didn't have the capacity to wage war, and indeed did not wage war against Israel at any serious point with any serious military, but certainly not in the Six-Day War. On the other hand, you had Egypt, let me take it away from Saudi Arabia for a minute. Egypt, which claimed it had the strong religious influence, had the military capacity, Jordan also, and they were occupiers of these fellow Muslims in Palestine. And yet Israel has been at peace with Egypt all these years while it continues to occupy Palestine. And so, but yet we hear all about Muslim terrorists. You mostly think Palestinians, who in fact, have not done that in recent history. So I just want to throw that out there. I don't know if you want to comment or not, but I want to go, if you do comment, take it to a more recent experience, and that's the Uyghurs in China. We got the Olympics going on now, and they're in Beijing, and one of the reasons that the U.S. government says it's not officially attending these Olympics is supposed to be the Chinese government's maltreatment of the Muslim population in China, which has a homogeneous population and its Han majority. But yes, clearly the Uyghurs in one region of China have been very poorly treated and oppressed and jailed and everything else. But let's talk about that most recent example, I think, of hypocrisy, playing the Muslim card when it's convenient one way, playing it another. You know, it's like the wild card, you know, but only it changes in value. And you either, sure, you're supporting Muslim rights when the Chinese communists seem to be against it, and you're, opposing it when it's Palestinians. But go on.
Yes, well, you were right about the hypocrisy and how we play both sides against the middle of the United States. The United States, talks a good game often about Palestinian rights. The Trump administration didn't, but traditionally the State Department will say, Palestinians should have rights of citizenship, they should have their own state. But the U.S. doesn't actually do anything to make that happen. And indeed gives tremendous support to Israel, which is doing everything it can to stop the Palestinians from having the rights of citizenship and to keep them stateless and to continue to take away from them their property and territory. And also to flood in hundreds of thousands of Israelis into the Palestinian territories, so as to dilute the demography of the Palestinians and to make it easier to control them and to split them up. And in many ways, there's a parallel between what the Chinese are doing in Xinjiang province and what the Israelis have done in the West Bank. Because the Chinese also have flooded in Han Chinese into traditionally Uyghur majority Xinjiang, and they have put the Uyghurs under heavy surveillance. And more recently, they've been arresting them and putting them through re-education camps, have been, disfavoring them. And for the same reasons, because the Chinese are afraid that if the Uyghurs remain a compact minority in its northwest, that they have separatist tendencies. And it may well be that the U.S. intelligence has played a role in whipping up those tendencies. And the Israelis are deeply afraid that the Palestinians, if they remain a compact population, will eventually manage to erect a Palestinian state. So the U.S. response to these two policies is night and day. With regard to China, it's vocal, it denounces. With regard to Israel, it's mostly silent and keeps giving Israel more and more money to buy arms with, which the Israelis use to regiment the Palestinians.
You know, this cynicism that you're attributing really to U.S. policy here, and doesn't make it any better to say other nations do it, but it's so profound and so many people get hurt. I don't want to end this conversation without giving it some texture. For instance, it's not just now in China that we're going to play the card one way or another. The whole Afghan war, for instance, the longest war we ever had, and now Afghanistan seems to be in worse shape in many ways. The latest stories is there's starvation in large areas and people are fleeing and so forth. So we set back Afghanistan. We initially got involved with Afghanistan. And again, I have to always say when I'm talking to you, you know, a thousand times more than I do about the actual history of these countries. But it seems to me under the old king originally and its old system, Afghanistan was not the worst place to live. It was a poor country, but in many ways quite tolerant. And certainly the condition of women was much better. And then it got caught up in Cold War politics, and there was a government in Afghanistan that was leading towards the Soviets, and you know, then they were secular, and the United States got involved with some people who were more claimed to be in the Muslim tradition who were going to oppose it, and there weren't enough of them in Afghanistan to put it crudely, that the U.S. got involved in recruiting people from all over, particularly the Middle East. Bin Laden was such a person to beef up the anti-pro-Russian government. And as a result, we got the whole nightmare of Afghanistan. They won. They supported the Taliban. And after that, we got 9/11. So there you have an extreme case of playing the Muslim card in a chauvinistic way coming back to haunt you, and probably the most graphic case. Why don't we end by talking about that kind of – it's not just a question of getting it wrong or being opportunistic. It's a question of spewing hate and evil in the world that comes back to destroy you.
Well, Bob, I couldn't agree with you more. I think you've made the case very well. And it's been a great conversation. I fear I have a thesis defense I have to run off to, but I really appreciate you reaching out, and it's always great talking to you about these things. Despite your constant cautions, you're one of the more knowledgeable people I know about these issues.
So can you give me the one sentence view of the misuse of the Muslim card, and particularly now that we close the chapter on Afghanistan? I see this as an incredible tragedy.
Yeah, well, the U.S. in various ways has been responsible for either promoting or provoking Muslim terrorist groups. It did, as you say, the CIA actually trained the Mujahideen in training camps and gave them CIA tradecraft techniques, which were probably then passed on to al-Qaeda. But then it did things like invade Iraq for no good reason, which provoked a Muslim fundamentalist response among especially Sunni Iraqis who had been secular. As you say, there's a long tradition of secular movements in the Arab world and in the Muslim world, including communist movements. And the U.S. Has, you know, worked through the last 70 years to destroy them often, and either to promote the fundamentalists or to provoke them.
On that note, I'm going to let you go to your thesis defense. Thank you, Juan Cole. And let me also thank Christopher Ho at KCRW for posting these podcasts. Joshua Scheer, who is our boss here, the executive producer. Natasha Hakimi-Zapata, who does the introduction. And the JWK Foundation, which in memory of a great journalist, Gene Stein, helps fund the work of our podcast. See you next week with another edition of Scheer Intelligence. Rien, c'est payé.